In her book, The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, Linda Gordon recounts a dramatic incident at the turn of the century that involved orphans and nuns, Anglos and Mexicans, cries of interracial transgression, and kidnapping. Linda Gordon is our guest this week, and here to speak with Professor Gordon is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
In 1904, 40 Irish orphans from New York were adopted by Mexican families in Arizona. Believing that to place a white child with a Mexican family was a form of child abuse, outraged Anglos seized the children and threatened the nuns who had brought them. This little-known episode, a tale of vigilante violence, racial and religious conflict, class and motherhood, is the subject of The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction by Linda Gordon, a professor of history at New York University. The book has received the Bancroft Prize, the American Historical Association's highest award. Professor Gordon, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's begin with the children, with the orphans. What do we know about them?
Well, you know, one of the most important things we know about them is that most of them were not orphans in the modern sense of their word orphans. They were mostly children of lone mothers who were mainly poor, Catholic, Irish, some Polish immigrants to New York City. And they simply couldn't find any way both to care for their children and to support them. So they were forced to relinquish them to an orphanage.
Now, how do they come to be adopted by Arizona families, Mexican families, across the country?
Well, the crucial issue here is that they really had to be placed with Catholic families. That was the policy of the Catholic orphanage, because they felt that placing children in Protestant homes, which was what was most commonly done, was a form of genocide, essentially wiping out their religion. So they were searching for Catholic homes, and they had a system of shipping children out to the West, and they were going further and further west in their search for homes for these children until they had a priest from two twin towns in Arizona, Clifton and Morenci, and the priest rounded up 40 of his parishioners to volunteer to take 40 kids.
Now, the train arrives with the nuns and the 40 children, and they initially are distributed to the Mexican families, at least some of them are, to the Mexican families with whom they're to be placed. But how do the Anglos react to this distribution of children?
Well, it must have been an amazing scene as I pictured it, because you have two groups of women essentially watching the distribution of the children. One is the Anglos who lived in Clifton, Morenci, and the other were the nuns, and they saw two entirely different things. The nuns saw Catholic children being given to Catholic parents, and that was what they wanted. The Anglos, as the white people in that town were called, saw white children being given to Mexican people, because what the nuns had not realized was that the Catholics in Clifton, Arizona, were pretty much all Mexicans.
And it's not merely a reaction that they keep to themselves. There's soon violence, a posse is formed, and the children are seized.
Exactly. In fact, it's quite a remarkable case also, because it concerns a very common kind of Western violence, vigilantism. But in this case, the vigilantism was organized by women. These Anglo women got more and more upset at what they considered very genuinely was an absolute wrong, kids being given to white kids being given to dark people, and they got the whole Anglo community very riled up, and until they formed armed vigilante squads who went out and one by one went to the Mexican homes and kidnapped the children at gunpoint.
The children are seized, they're given to some Anglo families. The case ends up in the United States Supreme Court. What happens there?
That's right. It went through three different courts, and 2 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court said the same thing that all of the other courts had said. It upheld what the vigilantes had done and said explicitly that these Mexican people were, by virtue of their race, unfit to care for white children.
You've mentioned already that women played a role, especially on the Anglo side, but you actually in the book make a further point that, in a sense, women were instigators of the conflict on both sides.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Well, the whole project of taking in these children was a project of the Mexican women. I don't mean to imply that they did it without their husband's consent, but it was clearly something that they wanted to do because they thought it was a way to be a good Catholic, to take care of children who were languishing in an orphanage, perhaps because some of them were lonely. These were people who were mainly immigrants from Mexico, often far from their homes. It was certainly not because they wanted help in work, because these were very young children, between mainly 2 and 5, and this was not a town in which there was any child labor. This was not a farming town, but a mining town. So they started this rolling, and then on the other hand, you see these Anglo women who flew into just an absolute frenzy of anger about what was going on, and they mobilized the men to form a posse.
One of the themes of the book, certainly from beginning to end, is the nature of race. And I wonder what this episode reveals about racial attitudes and even more specifically racial categories, how race is defined.
Well, I think one of the things that first grabbed me about this story was understanding how it showed that at the exact same moment in history, race meant very different things to people in New York and to people in Arizona, for example. In New York, people would have said about these orphans, well, they are of the Irish race. Mm. And in fact, in about this period of time, the U.S. Immigration Service published a compendium of what they called the races of the world, which included somewhere between 80 and 90 different races in the way they thought about things then. On the other hand, in Arizona, people were gradually moving toward a very, very simplified racial system of simply white or Mexican. A very, very different set of perceptions. Furthermore, as I looked deeper into it, I also saw how even what was going on in Arizona was changing through time. So what was happening in 1903 was different from what had been happening in the 1890s and different again from what the situation was going to be in 1920. It just shows how really malleable racial categories are, even though people also treat them with great passion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you put it nicely several points in the book. You note that the orphans, these little children from 2 to 5 years old, although they couldn't possibly have known it or understood it, became progressively whiter as they left New York and went to Arizona. Members of the Irish race where they started, they end up being whites where they end up.
Right.
Another clash here is the religious clash. You've alluded to that briefly already. On one side, we find Catholics, and the other side, we find Protestants. How does that religious conflict play out here?
Well, that's very interesting, and I'm very frequently asked, in what way do I know that race was more important than religion? There's actually a lot of evidence for that. I don't want to imply that race is the only factor here, because there was a lot of anti-Catholicism among these people who stole the children. But one example of what I'm talking about is the fact that several of the white mothers who ended up with the kids at a time when they weren't so sure that they were going to win the Supreme Court case, they volunteered to convert to Catholicism because they thought it would improve their chances of getting the kids. For example, at that time in Clifton, Morenci, while there was a Catholic church, there was no Protestant church, not of any kind. Now, that's partly because the white people who were vastly more privileged were able to conduct religious meetings, say, in the schoolhouse, which Mexican people did not have access to. But these were really not church-going people, and they just didn't. The white people were not passionate about their religion in the way that the Mexican Catholic women were.
Is it possible to come to some conclusions about how the various themes that run through the book, class, gender, race, religion, interact? Is it possible to say that, generally speaking, one trumps the others?
I actually would. I'm very hesitant to say anything like that, and I think that that's part of why I liked having a real story, because, you know, in real life, real stories are always very complicated. They only get simpler if you get more abstract. And in this case, it's not only how issues of race and religion interacted, but it's in a very, very important way about how issues of class fit in there, because this was a mining town in which a very, very large mining company was gradually increasing its control until it became, a few years later, a complete company town. That's the Phelps Dodge Corporation. And part of its very prosperity was based on the fact that it was able to hire Mexican miners at very low wages, wages sometimes about 50% to two-thirds of those of Anglo workers. And so it was extremely profitable to them to maintain the subordination of Mexican people. And they were quite conscious of that. And they were also still reeling from a very major strike that had happened just a year before this, in which there was a lot of division of the community along class lines. So that's involved too. And I think what I hoped to say with this story is how these different forces can be intertwined in very complex ways, so that it's really not possible to say that one was the dominant force.
One of the interesting things too is that the passage of time doesn't seem to change the way in which these factors manipulate or affect people's understandings of the story. Near the end of the book, you talk about your conversations with current residents in Clifton and Morenci, and in many ways they remember the episode back in 1904 in terms of a more recent strike. What was it, 1983?
Right. But, you know, I think we actually have a lot of new scholarship, including work by psychologists and physiologists about the fact that we are always unconsciously reconstructing our own memories. And very, very few of us have really reliable recall of incidents in the past,
well,
because we
mix
those with experiences that have happened to us since then. So in that way, these people are very typical. Mm-hmm. It's just that it was very striking to me to understand that their memories did not jibe with the documentary record that I was digging up.
What happened to the children themselves?
Well, this is interesting. A lot of people ask me about that, and I had a very strong reason for not wanting to go there, not wanting to inquire about that, and that is that in this time, about a century ago, adoption was very rare and a little bit stigmatized, and in almost all of these families, these children were not told that they were adopted, and other people weren't always told, people who hadn't been there when it happened, and I think that in many of these families, to say that an ancestor back then had been adopted would have come as a surprise, and I didn't want to do anything to interfere in the personal lives of people today. So I did not research it. But a lot of, not a lot, but a number of descendants of these orphans sought me out, because through the grapevine they had heard that someone was writing a book about their story. After all, this is a very small town, and nobody's written a book about it before. And to the best of my knowledge, I have to say that they seemed to have led very ordinary lives. They did not seem in any way that I, as a very far outsider, could register. They did not seem traumatized, but, you know, by the time I started this, as far as I know, they were all dead. So I didn't have any individual connection with any of them. Mm-hmm. And really, I wanted to tell this as a kind of narrative that was really about the events of 1904 and only the events of 1904.
Some historians write what are quite obviously big stories. They write big books. You make the point that this story is in some ways a small one, but you write that the story allows us to learn something big by studying a very small story. What does the Arizona orphan abduction teach us?
Well, you know, for me, it turned out to be a new way of getting at some of the themes that have always been present in my work. I tend to be thought of as a social policy historian, and before I wrote this, I wrote several national-level studies of the history of important social policies, including welfare, including family violence. And one of the things I've observed in doing that is how people learn through stories. And I think this may be more characteristic of Americans, perhaps, than some other places, but you think about how people become riveted to issues like, say, O.J. Simpson, or the Monica Lewinsky affair, or a surrogate mother who then doesn't want to give up the child. So I was really very consciously looking for a story that had that kind of complexity and depth. And I think that I think that the story can teach us something, first, about how fluid racial ideas are, and actually how quickly they could be changed, which, in my view, is actually ultimately a rather optimistic conclusion. In other words, if these orphans could simply, in the course of a train ride, really change from being Irish to being white, well, maybe people could also change. And I think Americans are changing views about race as interracialness becomes much more common. I also think it's very important to understand that women who are so involved with family are often the people who have been responsible for policing racial lines. For example, a sub-story in this story is how, maybe 3 decades before this, intermarriage between Anglos and Mexicans was very, very common in the Southwest. But as more and more Anglo women came, they actually redefined that intermarriage as disreputable and really succeeded in stigmatizing it. And this was another one of the racial walls that was erected there.
Well, Professor Gordon, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Linda Gordon, author of The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction.